Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast. I know there are a lot of options out there, and I'm honored that you think we're worthy of your attention. Here's the thing. Why needs to raise $5,000, and we need your help to do it. At this point, we exist entirely on listener donations, and $5,000 is the minimum amount we need for 1 year of the show. There are fewer places to turn this year than there were last year. Budget cuts are likely to cause layoffs at the University of North Dakota, and small humanities grants are few and far between. We need your help to make ends meet. So please, go to philosophyandpubliclife.org and donate what you can to help us keep making the show. Any amount is welcome, and it's all tax deductible. All of the details are at philosophyandpubliclife.org. Thank you for listening, thank you for donating, and we look forward to hearing your feedback. Please enjoy this month's episode. Hi, welcome to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're talking with Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein and examining why philosophy won't go away. Philosophy tends to be invisible. We don't look at Luke Skywalker and shout, "Metaphysics!" when he tries to feel the Force. And we don't refer to Downton Abbey as our Aristotelian virtue ethics soap opera. We can label these things after the fact. We can also argue about whether the Force is real or whether Lord Grantham is a person of character. But these acts feel, to most people, like artifice, a nerdy sport for the select few. That's why my approach to public philosophy has always been to try to slip the explicit philosophical themes in through the back door. I like to get my audience interested in the topic first and then bring out the more subtle stuff once they're hooked. I like to show them that they're doing philosophy after they start doing it, because otherwise they tend to get self-conscious. Too many people think philosophy is not for them. They don't understand that they do philosophy naturally as part of their daily lives. I think my approach works. Why is now in its eighth season. But there's still some people, some professional philosophers especially, who claim that we're not doing philosophy at all. We're not quoting texts every few minutes. We're not narrowing our discussion to focus on technical definitions of abstract concepts. We're not isolating arguments, challenging evidence, or disagreeing about the veracity of premises. We're not fighting with each other. If you compared our show to what happens in a philosophy seminar room, there wouldn't be much resemblance. Sometimes, then, we at Y have to back up and ask the most basic questions. Are we doing philosophy? And what is philosophy anyway? To a certain extent, that's the point of today's show. We're going to look at the meaning and nature of philosophy itself. But there'll be more going on than just that, because if we're doing philosophy, it's because the discipline itself has staying power. For 2,500 years, this method, this art, has asserted itself on the human consciousness and refused to go away. People have tried to destroy it. They've killed and exiled philosophers. They've banned books and ignored scholars. But philosophy's still here. In fact, despite his death millennia ago, Plato, the greatest philosopher of them all, is still here too. Plato, the person who set the agenda for the rest of us, the person who more than anyone else modeled the philosophical method, Plato, the person whose name is so famous that everyone knows it, even if they've never read a word he wrote. This is where our guest, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, comes in. Her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away, is written for a general audience, but it tackles the subject head on. It unapologetically defends philosophy against its critics and places Plato in modern situations, offering an account, as only a novelist can, of what Platonic debates might look like today. What would Plato think about Google search engines? How would he write if he took over from Dear Abby? These are fun ideas, but they're enhanced by her willingness to stand up in the crowd and shout, "Look at me! I'm doing philosophy!" She doesn't sneak any of it in. You either like it or you don't. You read it or you won't. She's taking advantage of a luxury that a well-established author has that, if I'm being honest, a struggling radio show does not. She can be unabashed. Why radio is constantly caught between a public that tends to think we're too heady and academics who think we're welterweights. One of the exciting things about having Rebecca on the show is that she's managed to make a career out of the very project we're trying to succeed at. She reminds us that public philosophy needs to be brazen about its intentions. She offers, pardon the Platonic pun, no apologies. I would guess it was the need for unquestioned legitimacy that inspired Rebecca to write about Plato in the first place. People may doubt his relevance, but they wouldn't dare question his genius or influence. Plato is philosophy's patriarch. He describes it, refines it, and articulates the standards by which even now almost all of us evaluate our ideas. On today's show, I'll ask whether Plato is the measure of academic philosophy or public philosophy. And I'll start now by suggesting that the two are complementary. Seems to me that public philosophy appears when academic philosophy loses its punch, and that academic philosophy regains power when public philosophy goes underground. There is, I think, a historical cycle of influence that ensures that philosophy is always with us, even if it changes rhetorical form. And if philosophy is always with us, then Plato is as well, because Plato and philosophy really are one and the same. The rest is just explanation. We are all always learning. And now our guest. Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein is a philosopher and novelist. She was a MacArthur Fellow and a recipient of the National Humanities Medal. She's currently a visiting professor at New York University, and her latest book, her 10th, is Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. This is her second time on Why. Rebecca, thanks so much for rejoining us on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
The show is being pre-recorded, so we won't be taking questions live, but if you'd like to join the conversation, please visit our chat room at whyradioshow.org. Post on Facebook at facebook.com/whyradioshow or tweet us at whyradioshow. So, Rebecca, you'll forgive me for sounding a bit like Entertainment Tonight, but since we last spoke, you won the National Humanities Medal, which is totally cool as far as I'm concerned. Did you get to have a philosophical discussion at the White House, or is just the pomp and circumstance too overwhelming to even think that way?
Well, it was a very overwhelming experience, and I got to speak to President Obama enough to know that he was familiar with my work, and that was also very overwhelming. People told me that he, more than any other president in their memory, involves himself in the decision. As to, you know, so that this was all a philosophical discussion. No, but I did sort of get the sense that, you know, after his burdensome obligations are over, he would be a real good guy to sit down and have a real philosophical discussion with.
I mean, it seems to be, and I have two different motivations for asking this question other than just to talk about it. the first is, it seems to me at a time in an election cycle like this, when we need philosophical discussion the most, we have philosophical discussion the least, or at least the media doesn't offer any depth of discourse. And I wondered, is there any sense that – I'm leading the question here, but is there any sense that the humanities medals are models for the rest of us, that what – the president wants, what Congress wants, what the NEH, of course, the National Endowment for the Humanities wants, is to nudge us to a different kind of conversation?
Well, I think perhaps. I think certainly the NEH and its current head, Bro Adams, has been going around the country urging the relevance of the humanities to political discussion. I have to say, segueing into the topic of today, Plato, it's terrifying to me to hear Plato warning against the great dangers that face democracy, and specifically his warning that when the public ceases to see the distinction between entertainment value and true value. In electing its leaders, a democracy is facing something really scary.
I think that's a really intriguing idea, because there are two themes that come out of Plato's discussion. The first, which we've seemed completely to forgotten, which is wanting power disqualifies a leader from having power, right? That to say I want to be president is probably a sign that you shouldn't be president. And then the second is the great problem of democracy, right? Is does collective ignorance mean knowledge?
Yeah. So, I mean, he put all these safeguards into place in the Republic Somebody, the guardians of the state, the people who had ruling power, weren't able to own private property. They had fewer privileges than their fellow citizens, and this was, you know, to dissuade any who wanted the privileges of power from even attempting to gain it. So, plus the rigorous training that he puts his guardians through, so that they can see deeply into the philosophical issues that underlie just governing. So, yeah, it's a very serious business. It's a serious business to allow people to vote for their leaders, and voters. Have to be well prepared to be able to distinguish between when they're being swayed by demagogues and when they're not.
And I want to talk about that a little bit later, particularly because you have a discussion briefly in one of the dialogues you write from the book about tyranny and what the tyrant looks like. But I want to go back a second to the Humanities Medal, because I said there were two reasons why I asked the question. And the second is that the way that Plato describes Socrates, he can think philosophically in any circumstance, right? He's on a military campaign and he'll stop and he'll think so hard that he won't move for the entire night, or he'll be compelled by his erotic attraction to someone else and he'll be able to convert that into philosophical energy. Is that something that we should strive for, that you would like to strive for, the ability to sort of use philosophy as a filter regardless of the circumstance? Or is philosophy something that should be turned off and on? And I say that in part because my wife, sometimes with incredible exasperation in her voice, says, "Oh, you're never not a philosopher." And so do we want to appeal to that Socratic model that philosophy should always be there, or do we want it more contained, more of one tool in our box to use when we think it's important?
Yeah, you know, I think it is the philosophical aspects, the philosophical questions that we might possibly ask, erupts in almost every situation. It doesn't mean that within every situation, when you're in the grip of the situation, that it's always the best thing to do to step back and reflect on it philosophically. So, for example, motherhood or the special motherhood or parenthood in general raises all sorts of philosophical questions. I mean, am I justified to prioritize the well-being of these two creatures above all others? And questions that, for example, the very strict, rigorous utilitarian Peter Singer has questioned. And these are genuine philosophical questions, and they're extremely important. But I have to say that if I had devoted myself single-mindedly to them while I was taking care of my children and trying to give them a sense of their place in the world and how important they were, That would have been misguided, and it would have ill-equipped me to be a parent. So don't think that those questions weren't always going through my mind. Of course they were, but there's a time when you stifle them, and attend to what you have to attend to.
And that question that when do you attend to them? When do you stifle them? When they're in the background? When they're in the foreground? That I would assume must just travel through all of your writing, because of course you jump back and forth from fiction to philosophy, often in the same text, sometimes on the same page or the same paragraph. And so is there a conscious decision on your part that now I would like to be philosophical with my characters, now I would like to create a quandary that the audience has to face? Or is your hat as a fiction writer just a different kind of do construct things differently and put aside the philosopher and then maybe switch as you see fit?
An interesting question, and one that confuses me. I think I'm always a philosopher. My training is in philosophy. It's what I know how to teach. I don't teach fiction writing. I don't know how to teach it. All of my fiction always begins with philosophical questions. They're always playing in the background. What I've tried to do is experiment with different forms of writing philosophy, because I do believe, as I know you believe, that philosophy is just part of our interest as human beings, that it's almost a defining characteristic of us. As soon as we have the luxury to think at all, to reflect at all, we start wondering about various philosophical questions, questions about mattering. I mean, do I myself matter? Is mattering something I have to achieve? Just basically questions of not wasting our lives. These are philosophical questions. There are much more technical philosophical questions. I'm not saying that these absorb all philosophical questions, but to be human and to have, you know, some luxury for reflection is to right away start thinking about these questions. And so, I experiment constantly with ways of writing philosophy so that my thinking of the thinking of other professional philosophers can be connected up with the human concerns of just about everybody.
And this I think this is palpable when you just look at your list of works. I mean, you have a fairly traditional approach, wrong way to put it because it's for public consumption, but you have a book on Spinoza, you have a book on Gödel, now you have a book on Plato, although there's a lot of playfulness in that, and then you have these novels. You have The Mind-Body Problem, you have the 31 arguments for the existence of God.
36.
I don't want me to short sight God or you. You have all these novels. How much of that is mood? Oh, I feel like writing a straight up philosophy book this time. How much of it is a grand plan? I mean, I don't think John Irving has a sense of a corpus, but we as philosophers were pressured from very early on to think systematically and to develop themes. So when you go back and forth from one style of writing to the other, how deliberate is it? How attached to your grand narrative of your life is it, and how much of it is just what you happen to be interested in at any given moment?
Yeah, I think it's really the latter. It's the kind of question that I'm thinking about often because of what I'm observing going on around me. And so, for example, the 36 arguments for the existence of God, whose subtitle is A Work of Fiction. That's a very important subtitle. And it's the first joke of the book. I had gotten involved because of my Spinoza book in what I call organized non-religion, you know, all of these many American organizations, and also in Britain as well, but especially in the U.S., of freethinkers, of secularists, of atheists, of agnostics. And I got invited, because Spinoza is, of course, a hero to these people, to a lot of these conferences. And I just thought it was terrifically interesting. And I also felt that, although I often very much agreed with their metaphysics, you know, with their view of reality, I'm not a God believer myself, I felt that they weren't really getting the complexity of religious psychology, or that there is no such thing as religious psychology, and it's not just a dumb mistake that people are making. That there's great complexity there. I myself came from a religious background, which I left, but I have a real appreciation for the complexity and lack of stupidity of at least, you know, some people who hold by these views. And I just kept thinking about writing something, and then I thought, no, you know, here's what where I usually get pulled into a novel against my will, because it's novels are really hard to write. And it's always against my will. But when I feel there's a real emotional core here that's being overlooked, and that it's important for people to grasp this emotional core in order to see how the diversity results, that's when I start thinking about fiction. Because fiction can really lead by the emotions. You can get to the ideas by way of emotion. And that's when I start thinking in terms of trying to find a story, trying to find the right characters.
It strikes me in hearing you talk that maybe I'm surprised it's taken you so long to write about Plato, and for two reasons again. The first is Plato, and you talk about this in the book, and we'll talk about it after the break. Plato spends a lot of time making arguments for things that he probably doesn't believe, right? So he doesn't have to be a partisan. He just has to explore. But second, at very key moments, and the history of philosophy ends up doing this as well, following him, at very key moments when he wants to articulate a truth, he goes to myth. He tells an allegory. He doesn't articulate the truth as a proposition. He gives us this emotional, this literary entrance into this discussion. And there are some metaphysical reasons he articulates for doing this, or epistemological reasons. But it seems like to a certain extent that's part of what you're doing, is there's this core of this idea that you want to communicate, that propositions will not suffice. You need to tell a story. You need to invent a character. Is that at all how you think about it?
Yeah, I do, very, very much. And I think that philosophy, well, just a lot of things, but one of the things that it does is to pose questions that we're smart enough to grasp, but not smart enough to answer. And that may just happen to be because of our own, you know, cognitive apparatus. It could be that Martians would find our philosophical questions trivial, and other questions that we find trivial, easy to answer. But for whatever reason, there's a gap for us as knowers between all of the empirical evidence that's available and our, you know, deductive powers to come to an answer for about questions like free will and agency, and about the hard problem of consciousness, and you know, a great many about the reality underlying mathematics. Is this a descriptive or simply a higher form of chess? All of these questions that are philosophical. There's a gap, and yet we reach conclusions. If we're philosophers, we may hold off conclusions. But if we're, you know, regular people, or if we're being philosophers in our regular lives, we reach certain conclusions, especially regarding questions that that we have to decide on, ethical questions. What does this? What fills in the gap? Well, my belief is that it's our philosophical temperament, our character, which is largely emotional. It depends on such questions as, you know, how do we feel about mystery? Are we allergic to it? Do we feel we've got to drive it out? Do we revel in it, or do we accommodate ourselves to it, you know, begrudgingly? These are highly individually variable responses to questions that are going to determine, you know, the kinds of orientation, philosophical orientation we have. Character. So I see character as being very, instrumental, very central in philosophy, right there, because in a second,
I want to ask you about character. We have to take a break. And when we get back, I want to talk a little bit more about this tension between character and argument and philosophy and novels. And then I want to dive into Plato with the Googleplex. You're listening to Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein about philosophy in general, about why philosophy still exists, and about her work and her latest book, Plato at the Googleplex. You know, I know this is going to sound odd, but I remember what I think is my first intellectual insight, or at least in any academic sense. I was a big fan, and still am, of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. And I was reading the second book, Prince Caspian, and there's a scene at the very end where one of the major characters, Susan, is talking to Aslan, this lion character. And she says, "When will I see you again?" And he says, "Well, you're too old. You can't come back to Narnia." And she says, "But I will miss you. I need you in my life." And he says, and I don't think this is an exact quote, but it's probably pretty close. "Don't worry, child. In your world, I'm known by a different name." And I remember at 8, 9 thinking, oh, I get it. This is an allegory. Aslan is God. And even though C.S. Lewis is of a religion that I do not subscribe to, and there's Christological stuff in the books that don't interest me, the Chronicles of Narnia have always been for me this incredible mix of emotional and intellectual experiences that have helped explain me to myself. Skip ahead to me teaching my students, and I talk a lot about literature and philosophy. And I always describe Victor Hugo's Les Miserables as a 700-page argument for why it's sometimes okay to steal bread. And I say that you can't have a utilitarian argument for it that's convincing. You can't even have a deontological argument. What you need is this story, but it is an argument. And so, Rebecca, getting back to the question I had for you a moment ago, and we were talking about characters, there was a time, Plato's time was a time, the late 19th century, earliest 20th century was a time when novels and the things we traditionally call literature and fiction and plays, even paintings, could be regarded as philosophical argument. Dostoevsky, Victor Hugo, Aristophanes, not in that order. Now there's reluctance to think of literature in that way as philosophy. In fact, it's thought of as old-fashioned and quaint and non-postmodern. Do you resist that? Do you think of your fictional works as philosophy, or are they fictional works with philosophy in them?
Yeah, I do think of them as a fictional works with philosophy in them. The one argument I suppose that I feel I'm making with my fiction is that that philosophy is percolating underneath life all the time, and that it's partly, you know, our part of our differences are our philosophical differences. And that, you know, quite often when I have my characters not getting each other, and great tragedy or hilarity, you know, comic hilarity ensuing because they don't get each other. It's because they're not getting each other's philosophical orientation toward the world. They are literally living in different worlds that are non-colliding worlds, and that's you know, that's both can be extremely funny and quite tragic too. So it's so in that sense, you know, that's something I believe about philosophy. It's a metaphilosophical view I hold that feeds a lot of my fiction. But I don't want, in general, the philosophical arguments that I have my various characters exploring. I'm not necessarily espousing them, and nor do I want them to take over and destroy the enchantment of fiction itself. Fiction that has too many ideas sticking out of it, and that is clearly for the purpose of making an argument, I think fails as fiction.
I love that word enchantment. It's such a useful foil for this discussion, in part because, and I'm going to say something very inside baseball for a second, I think phenomenology tries to use enchantment as a philosophical argument. But do you think then that there is a right way and a wrong way to write philosophy? Do you think that the way that grad students, that Bertrand Russell, that these more technical minded folks, do you think that that's the proper way to write philosophy, and that deviations can be useful in certain circumstances, but they are deviations from an ideal?
You know, I'm actually very Catholic when it comes to my views about writing philosophy. I think that there are, you know, Catholic with a small c. I think that there are many ways of writing philosophy, depending on what your goals are. So I don't at all dismiss or belittle or despise academic philosophy. I myself am a great consumer of analytic philosophy. That's what I was trained in. I learn a lot by it. I think that it pushes the field, you know, forward, but it's not easily translated. It's not for everybody. It's technical, but I also think that there's a, as I said before, that we all think about philosophy. It is really part of being human. And that it's the responsibility of philosophers, who have the great luxury and the training to think about this 24/7, to address, you know, the public at large, and bring what's some of the fruits of technical and analytic philosophy to people in general, and to connect up what's being done within the academy with questions of general human concern. That's exactly what Plato did, and Aristotle too. We don't have his dialogues. But, you know, Plato established the academy. He is the founder of the first European university. He gathered together all of the greatest mathematical thinkers of the Greek world, because he thought that mathematics was the key to the structure of reality, but he also wrote these dialogues, and the two different kinds of writing. And Aristotle, you know, also wrote dialogues, unfortunately lost, but one, two different kinds, and we have, you know, what were probably his lecture notes, but two very different ways of writing for professional philosophers, and then just for people in general. I also hope to be writing for professional philosophers, and I've been lucky that way. You know, professional philosophers do read me and get in touch with me and argue with me, and so I certainly want to write, when I write these books, I want there to be enough of interest to professional philosophers as well. But I think even something as technical as Gödel's incompleteness theorems,
which you wrote a book on,
which I wrote a book on, yes. has great interest to people at large, you know, wondering about the limits of knowledge, how far can we push it? Are there things that we know but that we can't prove? You know, these general questions that are of interest to people and are also emotionally fraught. I'm a great one for believing that almost all philosophical questions have an emotional aspect, which is, you know, has to do with our trying to find our way and our place in this world in which we happen to find ourselves in. It's a confusing business, and I think it's one that churns up all sorts of emotions. It has to do with the limits of ourselves, our knowledge, and ourselves.
And that leads us, you stole my segue, by the way, but that leads us to Plato with the Googleplex, which is clearly an attempt to communicate a lot of what you just said in a package that is not only accessible but relevant and connected to some of the great questions that span time but that have particular manifestations in our time. And the book alternates between more scholarly discussion of the history of Athens and Plato's life and how to think about the Republic and apology, and then these dialogues of Plato showing up at the Googleplex, which is the Google complex, and Fox News and an advice writer and getting an MRI. Let me start by asking, what do you want people to experience when they pick up this book? Do you want people to fall in love with Plato? It certainly seems that way. I'm not sure how to ask this first question about the book without leading you to all these different answers, but the book is of two different types intertwined. It's like shuffling a deck. How do those two tasks, the creating a new dialogue and the more traditional academic style or scholarly style, how do they meet in the middle? How do they overlap?
Yeah. Well, even in the expository parts, I hoped to avoid the typical academic writing. I suppose because I made personalities quite central, even in the expository writing. And these deeply emotional questions of, you know, where am I and what am I and what ought I to be and what's in store for me? All the questions that we ask, that we can't help but ask about our lives just in being reflective people, which is what it is to be human, if you have the luxury, if survival is not taking all of your attention 24/7. So I always feel that I have to add that because, you know, it's a bit of a luxury to even be able to stop and worry about philosophical questions. But you know, even in the expository part, I did want to, you know, connect with everybody. It was not meant for academics. And then I guess those dialogues in which there's real character, and I had to go about creating a character for Plato, about whom we really know very, very little. He's a very remote figure. I wanted to find another way in to making the points that I had just made in the previous expository chapters, a playful way, and because I do think that philosophy, you know, ought to be it's quite solemn, but it's also very playful, and it's the sheer joy, the exhilaration of playing with ideas, and I wanted people to get that feeling from the dialogues, but also to see the continuity of the questions that Plato first raised with the questions that they are considering. And for example, raising children. So I have Plato go to, he's on a panel with child rearing experts, including somebody who is a kind of tiger mom.
Which I have to say is an exhausting panel.
It's an exhausting panel.
The aggressiveness of the interlocutors, I mean, it's the 92nd Street Y, so it's consistent with certain character types. But, oh, my God, it was just exhausting to read.
Yes, it was exhausting to read. It was exhausting to write. It could have gone on forever. I mean, it probably goes on too long, but it was just, I could not shut those characters up. Once I gave them their point of view, I could not, they were irrepressible. But you know, everybody does wonder, you know, like if you have kids, this raises all sorts of philosophical questions. What do we do? Do we want our kids to be happier? Do we want them to be achievers? What's important in life? And if we don't think about it for ourselves, we certainly think about it in raising our children because we think that we have some control over that. That itself is an interesting philosophical question. Do we have any control over that? But I wanted to introduce these questions that have a tendency to sound rather abstract to in any way I could in the expository chapters and in the dialogues to attach them to central concerns that we all have, erotic concerns, child-rearing concerns, you name it.
You make a very important literary decision that a lot of people have not made when they've tried to do what you've done, which is you've made Plato the interlocutor in the dialogue rather than Socrates. Plato writes using Socrates' voice, which is one of the complexities in reading Plato. And often when people write dialogues and when they're talking about even the Platonic questions, they continue to use Socrates. But you haven't. You wanted to use Plato. Why did you use Plato, who never, except in a few letters, wrote in his own voice and who clearly wanted to hide behind this character of this person who he admired very much? Why did you choose Plato as opposed to Plato's characters to develop what you wanted to put on paper?
Yeah. Well, I believe that Plato is really the founder of philosophy, of Western philosophy, that he took some questions existing philosophers, the pre-Socratics, and certainly Socrates, he was able to isolate what is the nature of a philosophical question, and he extended it throughout all the human concerns and areas of inquiry, and often asked the paradigmatic philosophical questions in these various subfields of philosophy: philosophy of language, philosophy of art, you know, political philosophy, ethics, philosophy of education, even philosophy of science, even though there was no real science yet to speak of. It hadn't really been developed. Certainly philosophy of mathematics. I mean, just you name it. He asked the paradigmatic question. He had a real nose for philosophy, this guy. And really, you know, I think in the book I use the metaphor of, you know, that he raises the sunken continent, this submerged continent of philosophy up before us, you know, like Atlantis rising from the sea, which is really an apt metaphor because our first reference to Atlantis comes from Plato. Right. You know, he may have created this myth. As you say, myth is so very important to him. He's a Greek, after all. Myth is very important to the Greeks. So that's why I wanted it to be Plato. But of course, you know, it's a huge challenge because, as you said, Plato never speaks in his voice. He says in the seventh letter, if that's authentic, that he has never confided his true philosophy to writing. He doesn't think it can really be put down in writing. He was a great one to believe in lived conversation and in dialogue, in which these written down dialogues, they're only a simulation of the real lived, you know, living conversation, the back and forth of true philosophical conversation. So it was audacious of me. I mean, I kept the idea first occurred to me of putting Plato himself, making him a voice, creating a character for him, I thought, oh, now, Rebecca, now you're going too far. This is, I mean, how dare you, little girl. But
if only you had some job security.
Right. So it was, but what I ended up doing is giving him what I consider to be the character of philosophy itself, philosophy as I truly believe in it, not as it's often represented by living philosophers, but as I think, you know, the spirit of philosophy itself, which is playful, but is also very aware of the tragic dimensions of life, and is always open-minded and ready to be corrected, and always looking for somebody to offer the counter-argument, or trying to offer the counter-argument oneself, and you know, taking it all very seriously, but also seeing the great fun of it all. That's the character I ended up giving to Plato. And the other thing, and that this I think is historically accurate, my Plato, I think there's one thing we know about Plato, and that is that he loved Socrates. I mean, his making Socrates present in 25 out of the 26 dialogues that he wrote, we have all the dialogues that he wrote, is itself extremely significant. And so there is a personal love there. There's love of wisdom, love of truth, love of goodness, all of that, love of beauty, all of that stuff that Plato, that stands for Platonism. But there's also a very personal love, Plato's love for Socrates. And I think that's really interesting. So that's something that I think is historically justified and something that I made central to my character of Plato.
You also depict many of the characters that he interacts with as having deep love and appreciation for him. When he's at Google, there's the computer programmer with the very bad teeth who clearly is in awe and just loves being with him. And all the way to the end when he's getting the MRI, and there's Agatha who clearly is annoyed by her colleague who has nothing but contempt. And I have to say, I particularly loved the Googleplex story. And there's a point where, towards the end, where Plato is starting to prepare to speak to the crowd. And I got choked up. I was very moved by this idea that...
Hooray!
It was a really impressive moment because, I mean, I never really thought about it. This is one of the consequences of you choosing to write about Plato than Socrates. I have emotional feelings about Socrates, but I understand Socrates is a literary character. Socrates is a construct of Plato or Xenophon or Aristophanes, whatever writing, and that, as I insist with my students over and over again, Plato did not have a tape recorder. These are not transcripts. These are works of art. So I understand that. But the idea that I might, even through you, get to see or hear or talk to Plato, that's incredibly powerful. And I think that brings up that stuff that you've been talking about for a while, which is this emotional content of these questions, because we not only have emotional relationships with the questions, but we have emotional relationships with the deliverer of these questions, right? Plato thought there was erotic attraction between teacher and student. And I don't think he was just projecting his feelings for Socrates. I think there is often this deep gratitude, this deep appreciation. I've been taking piano classes here at UND, and I have just immense affection for the people who have allowed me to sit in this class with undergraduates when I'm clearly incompetent, and they just welcome me. Yeah. Do you feel worse or better or no different about Plato after having written this book? Now that you have a more concrete Plato to think about, your Plato, the Goldstein Plato, do you have a different relationship with Plato now than you did when you started?
Oh, I did. So very much. But let me just back up for a moment, and because one of the things I did in those dialogues is that I often also included people who are extremely hostile.
Yes.
to Plato and to philosophy in general. So there is his media escort when he goes to the Googleplex, and she's like, oh, who does this guy think he is? He only uses his first name as if, like, he thinks he's Prince or Madonna or something, you know, or Cher. And she's a very practical, no-nonsense person who, you know, by the end is thrown into... doubt, self-doubt. I mean, she's a person who thinks she has, you know, all of the answers to everything, and there's no opening. And just being exposed to, you know, the spirit of philosophy, which is what I wanted my Plato to represent. She's wondering if she has all the answers, and of course, that is the deepest lesson that philosophy can deliver to all of us to wipe away any vestige of smugness and see all of the questions that our smugness was covering up. And at the end, the neuroscientist is, of course, he's one of those guys who thinks that, you know, neuroscience has answered all of the questions about free will and moral agency and moral responsibility. And, you know, he's full of contempt for this philosopher. And by the end, he's won over to a kind of begrudging respect and even love. And I always know a book is done if I become choked up at the end. If I'm not choked up, then I know I haven't finished the book. And when Plato is, when he's won over this smug neuroscientist, and he is being pushed into that machine, the brain scan, and you know, I got choked up because I was saying farewell to my character, whom I had fallen in love with in a way that I don't feel about, you know, what I take to have been probably closer to what the real Plato was like, who could be kind of prissy and censorious and you know, I don't know that I am very aristocratic, but I and a control freak. You know, there are aspects of what I think was probably truer of the real Plato that I'm not so very fond of. But there's enough of what I glean from reading Plato that to provide the ground for my expanding it into a character I loved. And I'm constantly quoting him. You know that I weave into these. I'm not making him up whole cloth, not at all. Right. What I had to do was really memorize those 26 dialogues so that in the course of creating my own dialogues, I would remember exactly a passage from the original that I could weave in as a way of demonstrating the continuity of our conversations with the sorts of questions that he took up. So I don't want, you know, to give the impression that I'm making this up whole cloth. This is really continuous with what he himself had written, whether he believed it or not. As you say, there's always a great room for interpretation of whether he's actually putting this forth or just exploring these various ideas.
And I will say, for those people who are not writers, who haven't tried to write themselves, There's a flawless execution of this in the book, where at no point when you quote him does it seem disjointed from the text around him. So, and this is really where your amazing skills as a novelist come in, but also just as a person who works with words so well, there is the speaking that he does in the dialogues is so accessible to the readers in a way that his dialogues, or at least some translations, are absolutely not. And yet it seamlessly enters into his own words, and it's never jarring. And that's an amazing accomplishment, I have to say, to be able to have your own construction of his voice overlap, connect perfectly with his actual words. I mean, that in itself is a literary accomplishment worth celebrating.
Well, thank you very much. It was... Yeah, I think that that's one of the aspects that cost me the most. What I was aiming for, so I mean, your words mean a tremendous, they mean a lot to me because this was something that I was really aiming for, that unless I actually footnoted, you know, where I was actually quoting the man himself, the dialogues, it wouldn't be noticeable. The reader would find it seamlessly fitting in with our contemporary discussion. And this is all in the service of saying, hey, all of us, we all are very connected to this kind of thinking that was originated by this extraordinary person, who was very much a person of his time as well. I really wanted that to be clear, that there was something about Plato's being a Greek, one of those exceptional Greeks, that explains how he was able to create this field that's still so meaningful to us.
And why was he able to do this? Why Greece? Why then? Why does philosophy show up there?
Yeah, I think
actually, I want to let you answer that question, but as you answer, I want you to answer a related question, which is also, in a sense, a Platonic question, which is, do you think that philosophy is an invention, or do you think that it's a discovery? Did the Greeks invent this method, or did they just get to the point of human inquiry where this aspect of human thought revealed itself to them? Which, of course, is a very Platonic question to ask.
Yeah. And it's very funny because I go back and forth on that. When I'm writing, I'll say Plato, the Greeks invented philosophy. And sometimes I'll say the Greeks discovered philosophy. So I seem to have a good deal of ambivalence about this question myself, which means that it's a good philosophical question. You can see it both ways. The Greeks, there's so much about them that is simply extraordinary. They invented or created or discovered so much, including, you know, abstract mathematics and, you know, the beginnings of science and certainly democracy and history as a subject, not just annals, chronicles, as well as, you know, this extraordinary art, timeless art and architecture and poetry and drama. I mean, they're just, they're amazing. So I think that part of their locating philosophy, inventing it or discovering it, has to be seen in the context of their general achievement-oriented society. And I think that has to be connected up with something that was going on, not just in Greece, but throughout many parts of the globe, that the philosopher Karl Jaspers had called a certain period of history the Axial Age. It's basically 800 to 200 BCE, when all of the extant religions were, all of the religions that have survived, their beginnings were all started during that period. Zoroastrianism and Hinduism and Buddhism and Jainism and Confucianism and Taoism, and the Abrahamic religion. So it's got some offshoots, Christianity and Islam, that come later than 200 BCE. But the roots, that monotheistic root, is during that period. And also Greek philosophy and Greek tragedy. So an extraordinary thing is that Confucius and the Buddha and the Hebrew prophet Ezekiel and Pythagoras, they were all contemporaries of each other. So there was a great, what I call normative ferment that was going on in various centers of civilization. And I think that's important because these were all places that had, you know, developed civilizations and the luxury to think about these sorts of questions. But there was a questions about, you know, the fundamental philosophical question, you know, do I matter? What do I have to do to achieve mattering? You know, what am I, you know, I'm here for a brief time. When I am gone, is it going to be as if I didn't matter at all? And the Greeks approached these questions that various religious traditions were trying to answer by way of religious, forging religious answers, religious paradigms that still exist today, they went about it through reason. That's what their philosophers were doing, or through art, because we also have the invention of Greek tragedy. And so it's so I think one of the things that, you know, one has to be aware of in answering why did the Greeks develop this approach to the questions of human existence and meaning and mattering, is that there was a general preoccupation with this question in these various centers of civilization. And what's amazing about the Greeks is they went about this question, although their society was saturated with religious tradition, they didn't use their religion to try to answer the great existential questions. You know, what does it all mean? They used, or at least their philosophers used reason, and their artists used tragedy and poetry, tragic poetry, basically.
Is this, I'm trying to think of how to ask this question. We speak so often about the classical Greek world that we think that it's easy to imagine what life was like then. Yet you say at one point towards the end of the book, this really insightful point, that one of the ways that we know that philosophy has progressed is that we can see the assumptions that Plato made that we now regard as wrong, that yes. Plato himself couldn't see.
Yes.
And is it fake reactionary conservatism to think so highly of the Greeks because they had slaves, because the relationship between men and women were very different than at least at our best moments we want them to be. They were a warring people, not that we aren't. And to what extent do we really understand the Greek world, and to what extent do we idealize it, and how much of the actual Greek world is our own, and how much of the ideal Greek word is our own, world is our own, whether we reach that ideal or not?
Yeah. So, oh my gosh.
Small question. I'm sorry.
Yes. And one of the points that I do want to make is that the Greeks were not, the Greeks in their striving for to be extraordinary, I think that one of the keys to understanding the Greek approach, not necessarily the philosophical approach, but the Greek approach to this question of you know, how do I achieve a life worth living, is that they had a striving to be extraordinary, and extraordinary because then they would be known. It was very important to them that they achieve a kind of acclaim, either individually or collectively, because that is the only way that their name could live on. And, you know, the Greek notion of kleos, which is a kind of glorious deed, or the fame that it brings, was very, very central to the general Greek outlook. And to some extent, the philosophers, certainly Socrates, I would say, and Plato, both bought into this, that you have to achieve something extraordinary, but also were challenging the notion that the measure of being extraordinary is fame, is the acclaim of the masses. Socrates didn't win the acclaim of the masses. He won a cup of hemlock. He was put to death by his fellow Athenians.
He didn't even get a free meal at the Prytaneum.
He didn't even, right, exactly. Although he, you know, with the ultimate act of chutzpah, he asked for it. But because he said, I've been delivering a great service to you, Athenians. You know, you vote me guilty, but I've been delivering a great service to you because I have been challenging your view as to what makes life worth living, that any kind of glory, any kind of celebrity, you know, having your name on everybody's lips, so it's as if, you know, you achieve a kind of immortality, that ain't it. right? That's not it. It's justice, and it's virtue, and it's knowledge, and it's wisdom. You know, maybe will not live you. You know, the great admiration of your fellow citizens. Well, maybe you'll annoy them so much that they'll try to shut you up, or so that. He's at once, Plato and Socrates, is at once very much a Greek in thinking that we have to do something extraordinary. We're not born into mattering. We have to achieve it with the life that we live. But he differed from his fellow citizens in saying it's not measure and celebrityhood is no measure of this. And that's, you know, I think, that is interesting. So part of what, you know, I think it's a big mistake to think of the Greeks as a society of philosophers. There has never been, and there never will be, I don't think, a society of philosophers. You know, human nature is not designed that way. Philosophy is not the default. It takes a great deal of effort, and it collapses. It collapses even for professional philosophers. So that that's one thing I would want to say about the Greeks. One thing that I do think that we know about them is that they were an achievement oriented society, and by golly, they achieved. They really did.
Yes,
it.
They did.
We're still talking about them, right? We can't stop talking about them. They couldn't stop talking about themselves. I mean, they were of terrific interest to themselves.
And you, when you talk about the ethos of the extraordinary, you suggest that they're replacing this fame with self-examination, that there's this ethos of examination, that philosophy itself becomes part of what their excellence is. And all of this is up against the wall of a battle you are fighting throughout the entire book. It starts off with a deep engagement and then ends with a dialogue about it. This battle you have with scientists, or certain scientists, and I know you have a lot of scientists in your life.
That's where I started, actually.
Yeah, well,
I
mean,
in physics.
And what motivates Bill Nye? What motivates Neil deGrasse Tyson? What motivates the scientists that you know to who are otherwise smart, educated people to have such venom and contempt for philosophy? What it always feels like is they're still angry that they weren't popular in high school, and they need to take it out on somebody, and so they're going to take it out on philosophers. What is it? Just a, I mean, some of it's a worldview. I'll let you answer the question. What motivates the attack? And do you feel that philosophy provides the vehicle? I mean, obviously you do. Are you happy with your response, that you feel like you have countered the attack?
Oh, well, since the attack, you know, is a very emotional one, and has to do with, you know, the particular characters and orientations of the philosopher, of the scientists, who are putting it forth. You know, I'm sure that I have not, you know, what I've done is futile, but it's in the nature of philosophy that you keep trying. It's in the nature of philosophy that you try to expose the hidden premises of your own thinking and of the thinking of those around you. And, you know, it's a joint effort because we're very blind to our own core, most basic premises, the ones that mean the most to us. They just, you know, we're as blind to them as a fish is to the water that the fish is swimming in. And so that's why dialogue is so important, you know, that we bring together people with diverse points of view. And those are the ones who can challenge us the best. And so I will continue to engage in dialogues with some of my best friends, truly some of my best friends, who can't see the point of philosophy, and who will make will depend on philosophical positions, positions sometimes that have been argued out by philosophers, in order to dismiss philosophy and to not be realizing that they are doing philosophy in trying to say that there is no room to do philosophy, and usually, you know, not doing it as well as philosophers do it, just as philosophers don't do the particular sciences as well as they do. That there's a, so it's what I would say is that basically they're sort of deaf to what philosophical issues really are, and are not even realizing when they are putting forth. For example, trying to stamp out philosophy by saying that it's science that tells us what reality is really like. I actually agree with that. I think that science is our best answer to what reality is like. But it takes a philosophical argument to even say that that's what science is in the business right. of doing, right? That's scientific realism. That is not, that's a science, that's a philosophical point of view to be able to put forth scientific realism. And so, you know, just in making this argument, they are just hastening over deep, profound philosophical issues and about which, you know, there's a great deal of philosophical literature. Every one of them does this. Every one of those of the often brilliant scientists who for example, Stephen Hawking in his latest book says, you know, philosophy is dead. One of the problems is that philosophers don't know science. I don't know how he can possibly say that.
Which is so bizarre, because I was rereading A Brief History of Time in the last couple months ago, and I turned to my wife and I said, this is the best public philosophy book ever written. It is all philosophy. I mean, it's science too, but you can't conceive of A Brief History of Time without understanding it. I mean, he starts off talking about Aristotle, for God's sakes, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But it's philosophy, and so I will we don't have too much more time, and I will have to ask the very basic question, why won't philosophy go away? But I want to hold that for a side for a second. I want to ask you sort of the flip side of this question, which is not about scientists but about the general public. And in a certain sense, this is connected to what you're talking about, but in a certain sense, I'm asking for a brief minute-long, two-minute-long masterclass for the writer that I am. How much background knowledge, how smart do you presume your audience to be? What struck me about the book was that the first chapter in which you're responding to science is full speed ahead, and you are sophisticated. I mean, the writing is clear, you're accessible, but you're sophisticated, you're assuming a lot, and you are taking the audience at their absolute best, including your interlocutors, which is the sign of a good philosopher, taking someone at their best as opposed to their worst. But in doing public philosophy and writing blogs, but in also a book that I've been shopping around for I'm not even going to tell you how long, the reaction by agents especially is always, this assumes too much of the audience. They don't want it to dumb down, but they want a simplistic linguistic structure, a simple language, and to not assume any background knowledge at all. You've been incredibly successful having very sophisticated assumptions about, and very generous assumptions about your audience. How much do you assume your audience knows without ending up only talking to a very select few group of people?
Well, I always try to assume that, you know, my audience doesn't know, but my audience has the capacity to know and to think. I mean, one of the great helps to me is I'm going to say this in all honesty. I think I'm an idiot. I really do.
I believe you're mistaken, but forgive me.
I don't think I'm particularly bright. And so I assume that Everybody is, I'm always being impressed by people's, you know, intelligence. I'm generally impressed by, I'm often horrified, but I'm generally impressed. And I feel like, you know, I would never feel like I am talking down, not in my life and not in my writing. Feel like, you know, maybe I know some things. I've spent my life, you know, thinking about things that other people have not thought about. And so maybe I've got something to report here, and maybe I've got some insights. But if I understand it, my basic assumption is if I understand it, everybody can understand it. Whether I'm talking about Spinoza, whether I'm talking about Gödel's incompleteness theorems, if I get it, anybody can get it.
So maybe I asked the question incorrectly then. How do you convince people that they will understand it? How do you get past, I mean, obviously there's the publishing business question, you know, how do you get past an industry that focuses on the lowest common denominator? But how do you, and this is a problem, this is the problem of the radio show, right? I mean, this is, excuse me, this is what I started the show talking about. We've been doing this for 8 years. And there are people who I personally think would love the show, but they've decided it's not for them in advance. How do you, if you assume that your audience is smart, as we do, if you assume your audience has the capacities as we do, how do you persuade the audience or the potential audience that they also have the capacities? I mean, in a certain sense, isn't this, I mean, Plato was struggling with this. Aristotle was certainly struggling with this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you convince a population that is convinced it's an idiot that it's not, that they're not idiots and that they would enjoy it and that they would have fun and they would have, and that they wouldn't feel stupid.
And that what they would feel, they would experience the great joy, the great expansive joy of coming to understand things that they didn't before, of feeling the progress of the understanding. It's one of the greatest joys, pleasures that one can have in life. And even falling into uncertainty about what you were certain about before, but knowing that that is progress, is a feeling of tremendous pleasure. So how does one do it? In a word, the word that kept popping into my head as you were speaking, how do we do it? Seduction.
How does one do it?
That's the reason why I broke out of the academic mold of writing in which I was trained to do, and that I think is of great value, and wrote such, you know, outrageous things as a novel. I mean, good Lord, I wasn't even tenured when I wrote my first novel, and you could imagine what that did to my philosophical career. It sunk it, right? It's taken me decades to try to regain where I was as a young assistant professor who was writing exactly as I had been taught to write. So, but I think it's really terrifically important, and it's particularly important in a democracy in which, you know, the citizenry is given great responsibility for creating a society by voting its leaders. That these are very, this is a great responsibility. Plato thought that we were not up to it. I would love to think that, you know, the last few hundred years of this, American democracy has proved Plato to be wrong, that we really are up to it. But I think these philosophical issues of, what do we owe to society? What do we owe to each other? What is the state all about? That these are questions that are a responsibility for voters to think about. So I think it's terrifically important to bring the philosophical issues out into the open. But, as I've said so many times, in thinking how to raise our children or how important romantic love should be in our lives, why it consumes so much energy. Should it do that? Is it part of the good life? These are all questions that you can't avoid in being a human. What is knowledge? What is goodness? What is truth? These are questions that, whether we know it or not, we're constantly presuming answers to, and we ought to sometimes rethink our answers.
And is that why philosophy won't go away? Because as human beings, we have to do it. I mean, the George Orwell 1984 argument that, you know, you don't, even if you don't have the language for it, it's going to come up anyway. Is that why philosophy won't go away? Or is,
I think so. I mean, that it could go away. I mean, for example, religion offers answers to a lot of the questions that philosophers deal with. You know, what's the good life? What are we supposed to achieve in life? It's possible in a religious society to just accept a set of answers and false, but just to accept that set of answers from a religion itself is presuming certain, you know, philosophical right. issues. It's unavoidable. As soon as you go a little bit deep, there you are, whether in science, whether in religion, whether in life, you go a little bit deep, and you're going to hit philosophy.
Which
and it's
is
in our nature to go a little bit deep.
Which is, of course, the Delphic Oracle, right? I mean, the unexamined life is not worth living because examination, self-examination especially, is just philosophy. And so a life without philosophy is not a life worth living.
It's not. And it's a lesser life. I just want to say that, you know, there's a tremendous, I mean, we kept coming up again and again, you know, there's a tremendous amount of animosity, hostility to philosophy from scientists, certainly on one side, and religious people on another, and just regular people like my media escort in that first dialogue, that there is a hostility to this. What are you making problems where there aren't any? Plato himself has a wonderful answer there at the very dawn of philosophy as to why people tend to be hostile toward philosophy. It's in his dialogue, The Protagoras. And I think it's really an amazing argument. He said, look, if there was somebody who thought he was a good flute player, and, you know, he keeps getting up and play in public and playing the flute, and he really sucks, people are going to, his friends and his family are going to say, you know, stop it. You're embarrassing us and you're embarrassing yourself and you just can't play the flute. But if you say to somebody, you know, you don't know how to think about beliefs, you hold all these beliefs and you don't even know how to think about, you know, what you ought to believe. Or you perform all these actions and you don't even know the grounds for acting. If you say something like that, you know, which is a philosophical point, you're impugning their very humanity. It's okay to say to somebody, you know, you're not a good flute player, but to say to somebody, you don't even know how to believe, you don't even know how to act. We are professionals in this. Let us tell you how to do it. You are diminishing their very humanity. And so there's a very natural hostility towards philosophy. And I think we're seeing it, you know, that's at root of the scientists who are blasting philosophy. I mean, how dare you tell us how we ought to think? We're scientists. We're the best thinkers around. You know, don't talk to us about epistemology. Don't talk to us about how to justify beliefs. Or religious people, you know, don't tell us how we ought to act. We know better than anybody how to act. You know, everybody else is immoral. So there is a more general argument that you'll find anywhere, it is because philosophy really does go to the very core of us as humans. It's why it won't go away, but it's also why it raises up so much animosity among people, because they are being philosophers. They can't help but presume certain philosophical positions and just being human, and they don't want to be told there are others who are experts in this field. And I understand that. And I think that is, you know, that's a real challenge for philosophers. They can be seen as really obnoxious.
Yeah, no, and philosophers can be incredibly obnoxious, and especially to each other,
which
is a whole other conversation. And this, you know, this is the second time you've been on the show. I could leave this microphone on for 3 more hours and we wouldn't run out of things to say. Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for spending time and for the wonderful new book. And I hope the time comes again when you will join us for a third time.
I would love to. Thank you. It's always such a pleasure to speak with you.
You've been talking to Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We've been asking a whole range of questions. What is philosophy? How do you write philosophy? Where does philosophy come from? What its role is in contemporary society? Why philosophy makes people angry? And at the heart of it was this question, how do you get people to do philosophy? What does it look like when they do it? But how do you just motivate people to do it? This was Plato's problem. It was Socrates' problem. It's Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein's problem. It's the problem of Why Radio. And her answer is so interesting. Her answer is seduction, cater to people's emotions. It isn't cater to people's reason. That's, of course, how you do philosophy. But how do you motivate philosophy? You motivate philosophy by seducing people, by appealing to their emotions, by appealing to their passions. Why? Because philosophy is pleasurable. Understanding is joyous. Learning and seeing the world as it is and exploring these great ideas and these great beliefs involve just a celebration of the human experience that we don't really get the time to do. We're used to music, we're used to film, we're used to art that makes us passive observers. But philosophy is inherently an active event. Philosophy, to be philosophy, must be a reciprocal relationship. My listeners, I want you to write questions. I want you to imagine yourself talking to me, because what makes this show philosophy is not what we present to you, but what we create together as a community of inquiry. It's why I always insisted that this show be an interview show, because the dialogue between me and my guest is a dialogue that you are participating in, even if you are not in the room. This is Plato's insight. Plato wrote in dialogues because the reader, the listener, the person who is standing on the side is as much a participant because they get to be part of the conversation, even if the conversation is already written. Well, we are still writing conversations. We are still exploring ideas. And we are 2,500 years into a process that may last, and I hope it lasts, forever. We may not get the answers. We may not settle and agree on beliefs. But we can enjoy the discussion and the exploration and the disagreements, because figuring out what the world is, figuring out beliefs, and figuring out what makes us valuable and why we are here, well, that's part of what it means to be a human being. You're listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Radio. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower,